I gotta keep the Aristotle stuff in there.
Hey listeners, if you're working on a manuscript, we'd love to help. Email us about our novel mentorship program at napleswritersworkshop@gmail.com. Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
All right, it's your turn. So tell us about your story.
We did that story by Grace Paley, A Conversation with My Father, where the character kept saying, write me a story, but make it more like Chekhov or de Maupassant. And I saw his name in this book and I was like, let's do that one. I have never read Guy de Maupassant. So here's a Guy de Maupassant story called The Necklace. This version was translated by Marjorie Laurie. But one evening, her husband returned home with a triumphant air and holding a large envelope in his hand. There, said he, here is something for you. She tore the paper sharply and drew out a printed card which bore these words. The Minister of Public Instruction and Mademoiselle Georges Ramponneau request the honor of Monsieur and Mademoiselle Loisel's company at the Palace of the Ministry on Monday evening, January 18th. Instead of being delighted, as her husband hoped, she threw the invitation on the table with disdain, murmuring, what do you want me to do with that? But my dear, I thought you would be glad. You never go out, and this is such a fine opportunity. I had awful trouble to get it. Everyone wants to go. It is very select, and they are not giving many invitations to clerks. The whole official world will be there. She looked at him with an irritated glance and said impatiently, and what do you want me to put on my back? He had not thought of that. He stammered, why, the dress you go to the theater in. It looks very well to me. He stopped, distracted, seeing his wife was crying. Two great tears descended slowly from the corners of her eyes toward the corners of her mouth. He stuttered, what's the matter? What's the matter? But by violent effort, she had conquered her grief, and she replied with a calm voice while she wiped his wet cheeks, nothing, only I have no dress, and therefore I can't go to this ball. Give your card to some colleague whose wife is better equipped than I. He was in despair. He resumed, come, let us see, Matilda. How much would it cost a suitable dress which you could use on other occasions? Something very simple. She reflected several seconds, making her calculations and wondering also what sum she could ask without drawing on herself an immediate refusal and a frightened exclamation from an economical clerk. Finally, she replied hesitatingly, I don't know exactly, but I think I could manage it with 400 francs. He had grown a little pale because he was laying aside just that amount to buy a gun and treat himself to a little shooting next summer on the plain of Nanterre with several friends who went to shoot larks down there of a Sunday. But he said, all right, I will give you 400 francs and try to have a pretty dress.
Well, what'd you think?
I liked it. It's pretty good. For some reason, because in the other story it was paired with Chekhov, I was not prepared for it to be French. Even though his name is French, right? But I just wasn't prepared for that. But I don't know. I thought it was an interesting little story. Simple.
I wrote down, like, my immediate reaction was, it's a cautionary tale. It's like a fable or something.
It's got that fabulous kind of moral to it, right?
Oh, yeah. And it reminded me of, I don't know that it's an actual story so much as, like, something that people talk about. And I feel like I've heard it mostly around the holidays. It's like the story of the couple that's broke, and I forget what the guy does, but the woman cuts her long hair and sells it so that she can afford like a pocket watch for her husband, or a chain for his pocket watch, and he sells his pocket watch so he can buy his wife a comb, and she doesn't have hair to comb it with, and he doesn't have a watch to hang it from or whatever. And that story I like better because they're both doing it out of love for the other one, you know, they're both making a great sacrifice for someone else. And in this story, man, I couldn't knock it over this woman. She loves a pity party. And like, her husband's like, I have this invite. And she's like, well, I don't know what I'm gonna wear. Maybe you can give me a shit ton of money and then maybe I can go. And then she still manages to mess it up. So I don't know about you. I had like very little sympathy, and I usually do, for people who try to get away with something too. So like at the end there, instead of just saying like, I lost it, but I will buy it back, I will make it up to you, she could have avoided it all then. So that was like the other part of the tale for me. Like, to just come clean, and not come clean and say that you're not going to make your friend whole, but just take whatever is coming to you.
Well, that's the lesson of the sitcom, right? You wouldn't have a story if you just did the easy thing.
You wouldn't. I only point that out because that's why I didn't like this character. You know, I don't know what she learned from this, except that she thinks that she's going to get away in polite society, only to find out that she sort of like toiled for no reason to give a woman a fake necklace, you know? She had a fake necklace. was. And she wanted to be part of these people, but she could have been. They're wearing fake jewels, you know? She held them in such like high esteem, and it turns out they're all just trying to skate by somehow, right? They're all committing some kind of fraud of image. And she spends the whole night like, oh, look at me, I feel beautiful. And her husband's like asleep in the other room.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just she feeling beautiful. Everyone was fawning over her.
They were. Yeah. It worked.
I mean, that was the feeling she was looking for.
She wanted to
have that one day. That one day.
Yeah, and then she paid for it for a decade.
I mean, that's the story. I think you have to have that character for that story. I hear advice a lot of times is like, oh, give your character a flaw, or like, do this for your character. You got to make your character round. And for me, characters are more like, okay, here's the story. I might come up with the character first or a plot first, but they're usually tied together, like they're a knot.
Yes.
I cannot think of a story without the character being the character who would enact that plot.
Yeah, exactly.
That character has to be the kind of person who would make the decisions that make the plot go forward.
Right.
Any other person would not fit into that story. It has to be their story. So that kind of advice where it's like, here, tweak your characters in this way, just never makes sense to me because I already have the character.
Right.
It's suggested by the story. So this, in that way, this character fits this story. Like, this is the character that has to be in the story.
Right. It wouldn't work if she were any less, like, vain or, you know, wanting to fit in with these people. It wouldn't work if she was maybe more honest or, yeah, whatever. Yeah.
She has to be the kind of person who's going to not tell her friend.
Yes.
Has to be the kind of person who wants the necklace in the first place. Who overvalues things. Who finds satisfaction in being feted for a lie. Otherwise, the story would fall apart.
Right.
That's why you have to have clowns in sitcoms, right? You can't have good people.
Yeah. No episode of Seinfeld would ever have happened if everyone was normal. And
that's right. Yeah.
I guess the difference is sitcoms you can enjoy and laugh at. This, I wanted to strangle her.
Well, it's an interesting play on our emotions too, right? Because it's like, you feel badly for them. You're like, well, you really messed up. You shouldn't have done that. But at least they're trying to make it right. I guess.
Yes.
At least they're doing this, and like you feel kind of like a sorrow or a pity for them. And then at the end, you're like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
Undone by your vanity, maybe.
Yeah, it feels like vanity, except that she doesn't have the status to begin with. I don't know how vain you can be without the status.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
She's got the vanity. She doesn't have the status.
Yeah, so it's like, it's hard to blame her. Is it like, is she vain, or is she just like yearning for a different lot in life versus, does she really think that the most important things in the world or money and all this? I think she just knows that's what's missing for her, because there's this paragraph for me, well, it's the second paragraph for you too, but I liked this where it was talked about women don't belong to a caste or class. Their beauty, grace, and natural charm take the place of birth and family. Natural delicacy, instinctive elegance, and a quick wit determine their place in society and make the daughters of commoners the equals of the very finest ladies. And I wrote, agree. So she feels like she's trapped in her financial situation, but that otherwise, and maybe this night proves it, she'd be the belle of the ball. She's beautiful and she's charming and she wants to behave politely. So it feels doubly unfair to her, right? That this is just the missing piece. She doesn't lack the manners, or she would be comfortable in this place. She just needs the things that let her do it. Yeah, so she feels doubly screwed by that, right? It'd be one thing if she was ugly and poor, but...
I did want to talk about the way the dialogue is done.
Sure.
Only for this reason. When we read Eveline by Joyce, I made a comment about the version that we linked to for that episode had the regular quotation mark. And the version in the critical edition I was reading had the dashes that he preferred.
Okay.
And I said at the time, there's a lot to say about that, but I'm not going to bore anybody.
Now the time has come to bore the people.
Well, he was writing in France in the 19th century, and at a time when they used that style of the dashes.
Okay.
But I think all the copies that we've found of this story use the quotation marks. I found a French version of the story that maybe I can link to that has the dashes as originally used. But one thing you can notice is that style, if you were to write with regular quotation marks in a modern English style, you would say characters did something and said, comma, quote, and then what they said. And this style, all that happens on one line, and then the quote starts on the next line.
Okay.
And you can see it in the way it's laid out, even in the English translations. They split those lines up and put the quotes on their own lines. I think that it is something to think about as you're writing, is the kind of stylistic expectations meditation that everyone's taught is like when you change speakers, you change paragraphs. But in this one, you have a speaker or a person doing an action and then speaking in the next paragraph. So it's often the same person for two consecutive paragraphs, and then it'll switch.
Right.
And you'll have paragraphs without attribution. So if you're
yes.
having a back and forth,
right.
you don't put in those beats. Those beats go in their own lines, which is something to think about as you're writing, is like when you put that stuff in, where you put that stuff in. I think comparing this style with what we're used to from modern English is instructive for how to format or how to structure dialogue, irrespective of paragraph breaking, but like where to put in the beats, where to put in the exchanges without beats and attributions and that kind of stuff. That's what I wanted to say about that. That's all.
You mentioned like that it gives like that beat, right? Like another beat is like the character's reaction, and then it goes back to like who it is that's speaking. Like they do an action and then they speak. And if anything, like looking at this page where I can see that they've done it like 2-3 times, that is what it feels like. It feels as if instead of everything happening in the same moment that dialogue happens, that the scene is paced out differently. So we've talked about how some people think that every dialogue tag needs to include like, she said this as she sipped coffee. She said this as she set this down. She said this as she stood up. And not everything is done that way. Some things are done really quietly and some things are done separately. And here, what's interesting is like, she uttered a cry of joy. Of course, I had not thought of that. These are separate lines, right?
Yeah. In my copy, the joy line ends with a colon.
Okay.
To introduce the following.
Separate
is
lines.
Is it a period?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's separate
it's a period,
lines.
Period.
It's separate lines, but it's a colon.
Okay.
Which is
mine's
allowed.
Period.
You can
so
do
a
that,
colon
guys.
Is, yeah, colon's different. Here, I'm reading it like, the cry of joy could have been something like, versus, of course, I had not thought of that, right?
Yes.
The dialogue could be very separate from whatever that cry of joy was. And whichever it is, whatever's intended, it's good to think about it as being sort of separate.
Even an ordinary attribution is its own line. Like Mademoiselle Forestier went to a wardrobe with a glass door, took out a large jewel box, brought it back, opened it, and said to Mademoiselle Loisel. New line. Well, that, for mine, it ends with a colon. New line. Choose, choose, my dear. So the saying is introducing the quote, but
right.
that still goes to another line.
Right.
I can see, just looking at this and like the way it reads, I get a sense of why Joyce might have preferred it, like a guess of why he might have preferred it, because I can see why I would have preferred this way of formatting. I can see writing a story like this and trying it out just to give yourself a kind of a way to play with dialogue.
Right.
The structure of that.
Yeah, it's a way to play with dialogue, but it's also, if you're like new to writing dialogue in the first place, it's a good reminder that this is how real conversations happen. Like when you talk to your mom, she's not always running around the kitchen. Sometimes you guys are just sitting there and there's a break in the conversation and there's a pause and there's something slow and quiet.
Sip the coffee.
Yeah. And then of course, like all of those things take on like heightened literary meaning, right? Like she paused, she sipped her coffee. It's like, oh, she must be thinking something deep.
Because of what you just said, she didn't answer right away. She just took a moment to sip her coffee. Oh, that means,
That means XYZ. Yeah. I mean, and whether or not you intend that, that's another thing to play with, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't even notice that until you pointed it out. And so that's another good thing to mention, is that you don't necessarily need, you don't necessarily need the dialogue tags though. Like it works here. Like you're saying, like a lot of times when you get into a flow of conversation, it's speaker one, speaker two, speaker one, speaker two, and they'll tag it occasionally, but even this works.
Yeah.
At no point was I confused as to who was talking. And I think these two, the husband and wife, are different enough characters almost that maybe that's not even like necessary. Even like her friend that lends her the necklace is a different enough speaker.
Oh, one thing to say about that is like people say speakers can have different ways of speaking, different styles of speech to identify them. You don't even need that. It's like, what are they talking about?
Right.
Like the exchange between him and her that I read even was, she's focused on not wanting to go and he's focused on convincing her. So you can identify every line of dialogue by what its intentions are.
But I mean, you don't even like, sometimes you have to like read an entire line to like realize who's talking. This is, you don't even need the context clues to just like, the pacing is intact.
Yeah. And the little beats are there.
Yeah, exactly.
To guide you too.
Yeah.
I do like the idea of separating the beats out from the dialogue in its own paragraph as a way to train yourself to think about that structure, the flow of things.
Yeah. It forces you to be more intentional about that part.
Yeah.
Did you read any like criticism of the story after?
No.
Yeah. I like skimmed some stuff, but I'm always curious because I know that so much is lost on me in terms of the societal context in which a modern day reader would have read this, you know? And would they have read this and thought to themselves, oh, I don't want to go to the ball anymore? It's obviously actually talking about these sort of hierarchies in society and classes, but I didn't know if you'd come across anything else.
I did want to talk about something I read that's separate from the story.
Sure.
But it's the introductory kind of like biographical note on de Maupassant that's in this book. It's a book called The Story and Its Writer by Anne Charters, edited by Anne Charters. Yeah, so the little introduction, I'm not going to read all of it, but there's just this section at the beginning, like he was learning to write. He went to someone who's vaguely related to him, Flaubert, which you're like famous writer in your family. Yeah, I would go ask him questions too. It says, 7 years he apprenticed himself to Gustave Flaubert, a distant relative who attempted to teach him to write. Maupassant remembered, I wrote verses, short stories, longer stories, even a wretched play. Nothing survived. The master read everything. Then, the following Sunday at lunch, he developed his criticism. Flaubert taught Maupassant that talent is nothing other than a long patience, work. The essence of Flaubert's now famous teaching is that the writer must look at everything to find some aspect of it that no one has yet seen or expressed. Quote, everything contains some element of the unexplored because we are accustomed to use our eyes only with the memory of what other people before us have thought about the object we are looking at. The least thing has a bit of the unknown about it. Let us find this. I thought that was a great little encapsulation of the idea of like finding the writer's eye.
Okay.
Training yourself to find the details that other people aren't seeing. But this other part of this, it says his writing is characterized by compact and dramatic narrative lines. Maupassant's stories eliminated the moral judgments and the long digressions favored by earlier writers. Along with the Russian writer Anton Chekhov, Maupassant is credited with technical advances that moved the short story toward an austerity that has marked it ever since. These two writers influenced nearly everyone who has written short fiction after them.
Speak for yourself.
As Joseph Conrad recognized, facts, and again facts, are his, Maupassant's, unique concern. That is why he is not always properly understood. Lack of sentimentality towards his characters opened him to charges of cynicism and hardness. But that kind of like spare writing, we always credit like Hemingway and stuff with that, but it's not necessarily the writing that's spare, but he's not like, as Conrad is quoted as saying, it's like just the facts, just the information, just the story.
He's not editorializing.
He's not editorializing. The way, I mean, when we read that Conrad story, we were like, oh, here's an editorial line, here's an editorial line. And they were fewer than some like previous writers might have been. But it's interesting to think that that particular way of writing, that is just, if you look in a book, this is how you absolutely have to write, was influenced by somebody from the 19th century.
Yeah.
I mean, even in workshop today, we won't credit Maupassant for this or Chekhov. We'll say, you don't need to say that. Just show the what's happening.
And yeah, it's almost show don't tell.
Yeah.
Because what I was going to say is like, this might be free of editorializing, but the story itself, the plot points themselves, it's so obvious that this is telling us something, that there's a lesson embedded in it.
But it's never spelled out. He doesn't say it.
You don't have to.
That's the point.
Yeah, it's the difference between like needing to beat a dead horse or letting the story speak for itself because it's obvious.
Even your reaction to her character, to Matilda. He never says like...
Yeah, he doesn't have to like critique her or describe her. Yeah.
He just gives us the facts and then we come away with our own judgments based on that, which is what you teach, what we emphasize in the workshop, which is what every creative writing program or course or book suggests is the way to do it.
Like the show don't tell.
Yep.
Yeah. It's interesting because I want to read like The Tortoise and the Hare again. because there's something about like a fable and a cautionary tale that I imagine is done the same way, where the plot points themselves make it clear what it is you're supposed to take from this. It's bare. It's just, this is what happens. You don't have to remember like a clever line that the author has. You just remember the plot, like slow and steady.
I was really close to putting Aesop's complete, like there's you can get all of Aesop's fables in one volume, like Penguin, maybe Penguin Classics or something.
Someone put them all together.
Uh-huh. But I didn't. But I thought that reading all of those would be a way to study the story form, like what makes a story, just to go through those because they are so simplified and so elegant.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. They're simplified and like, I did not enjoy this story, like this experience of reading it. Do you know what I mean? This felt thin to me somehow.
It didn't necessarily have like some of the depth that you might get from other stuff, voice.
And I wonder if that's a natural consequence of this style, if it's intended. It felt simple. people in a certain way because it was absent of all of that.
See, I'm curious. My thought when I read that little blurb about he helped create that style.
Yeah.
It says these two writers influenced nearly everyone who's written short fiction after them. And I imagine that some people were influenced in the opposite direction. Like, oh no, I'm not going to cut everything out. I want to go the other way.
Yeah. Something about their approach, yeah, made people decide something.
Yeah. So we are taught that so much. Like maybe some stories would like you to go bigger.
Yeah.
To be more editorial, to be less merely the facts. And you think of stories with their own first person narrators are often like this because that's what's interesting. It's like the fact isn't what happened. The fact is what they think. Right.
Yes.
So you present what they think through their voice. And that's part of the story. So it's just where you focus the lens. Like, are you looking at the events? Are you looking at characters' thought processes? What are the facts that you're presenting? But there's probably room to expand that.
I was going
to
say too, like maybe what feels simple about this is I think there are stories that have plot, but the story itself is a character's reaction to what it is that's happened.
Yeah.
Like whatever lesson they learned or what meaning they took from something. Maybe that's what's absent here is that because we're just getting the facts and we're not necessarily even like learning what it is these characters thought by the end. Like how does it end? It just ends with her saying like, it was fake.
Yeah.
Oh, my poor Matilda. Mine was an imitation. It was worth 500 francs at most. That's how the story ends. So we don't get to see if she learned something. We don't get to see her reaction. That's off the page and that's up to the reader to interpret. And I think what literature can do when it wants to, and this author clearly wasn't interested in that, would be to have five beautiful paragraphs after the fact about how Matilda wanders aimlessly the rest of the day and is distraught and what she's thinking about and reimagining the past 10 years of her life. The fact that this is so bare bones, it feels simple that way. It feels like, okay, I get it. I have to go interpret it now. And I'm not as interested in my own interpretation of it as I might have been in his.
In George Saunders' book about writing, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain.
Yeah.
He talks about knowing when you're at the end of a story.
Yeah, and interesting.
The only way to go past certain points, like you could end a story here, but you have to find a way to escalate it, I think is the word he uses.
Okay.
So you come to an ending, and if you can push it farther, if you can escalate the stakes, the tension, the reaction, whatever it is.
Then maybe it's not over.
Then you can push it beyond that. But you have to, it can't just be like, I would say can't, but according to this kind of like trimmed down, just the facts kind of way of thinking about stories, you don't want to merely restate it. You don't want those five paragraphs to go on with her thinking, oh no, they were fake, and then rehash everything that came before, because we already have that. That's not an escalation at that point. So whatever those five paragraphs of rumination of her wandering the streets are, something else has to happen.
Yeah.
To drive home the point a little bit more.
I'm realizing like what I'm personally interested when I read fiction is all of the like interior thoughts of the character that inform the reader and no one else. You know, I want to be privy to something about a character's motivation sometimes. And sometimes that's only done when it goes beyond just the story. The show don't tell, you know, like, I don't know. This could be a different story if we spent a lot more time in her head or a lot more time with the editorializing. This still hits on all of the notes of it being about class and all this kind of stuff, but maybe it's because it's so easy to understand that it feels not good to me. Do you know what I mean? Like something needs to feel more complex for me to think that I've read something of note.
Interesting.
I don't know. I don't think we'll like talk about this one as being incredibly memorable. We'll remember it the way we remember The Tortoise and the Hare.
I think this story does what it needs to do.
Yeah.
There's a reason to go into a character's thoughts that this story didn't need. Dialogue often serves for giving the interior, especially this era, you get more out of the dialogue than you would get about reporting thoughts because a person reveals themselves in what they say and reveals themselves in what they do. So actions and dialogue, like those action beats we were mentioning before. I think for me, it always comes back to point of view and perspective. It's like, what is the story focusing on? If you think of it as a camera, what is it pointed at?
Right.
Is it pointed at the events? Is it pointed at the person's interior struggle? Then you would get more interiority. I don't think her interior struggle is interesting for this situation.
Yeah, it's just what she decides to do about it.
Yeah, we get enough of her interior struggle when we get her conversations with her husband and like the way she talked to her friend asking about the necklace, and even the interaction at the end when it's revealed. She finally decides, oh, I can finally admit to her what we did.
Right.
And then the woman stops in her tracks and is like, you did what? So you get enough from that that you don't need to see the inside. In a different story, if you were inside, it would be a different story. It would be about something else. Then the camera's pointed somewhere else. I think one of the thing that this little characterization at the beginning of this thing said is about there it is. His stories eliminated moral judgments. We come to feel about the character without being told what to feel.
Yes.
That, I think, is the powerful thing. It's like meeting a person in real life. You know, J.D. Salinger's stories, we don't get anything inside, but holy cow, do we understand those people because we get to watch them. And this is a similar kind of like objective point of view where you don't need to see inside to really get to understand them.
Right.
At the level the story wants us to understand them.
Yeah, at the level that's important for us to just get what's happening here.
Did she get a knot in her stomach? Did she have trouble swallowing? Like, those things,
No, yeah.
They might add color to it, but I don't think they add much else. It would be interesting, though. You would, like I said, change the story, but it would have a different focus to get inside of her head and follow the track of it. I think that's why people do rewrites, because they're like, oh, I'm interested in this character.
This aspect of it?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so maybe this is the other thing. Maybe if it weren't, like, a cautionary tale, then this style of writing might do better for me. But it seems so explicitly a warning versus...
I don't think it's that. I don't think it's only that. Because then it could just be two paragraphs.
Well, yeah. A lot of shit we read should be. But like, okay, like I'm thinking of like books that I read this year. Like I read two stories of divorce, one from the real woman and one from the real guy, their perspectives. And what's interesting about either of those is the nuance. You don't know who to blame. You don't know what ultimately led to the downfall. Here it's so clear, like a series of mishaps and lies. And absent of like my interpretation of what the character's thinking, I'm just like, yeah, you shouldn't have done that. There's no nuance introduced by her like impression of it that would make me think of this as like complex or worth engaging in on a deeper level. I can come away with it the way I did, where we're saying like, well, you know, the story wouldn't have happened if she wasn't this kind of person. I'm reading it and I'm like, she's vain, she's a liar, you know, I don't like her.
What was the name of that story we did recently? Taylor Cook.
Oh yeah, the wedding party.
In that story we get the interiority of the main character,
right,
the perspective character, but the story is about the girl, the woman that comes to him, and we come to understand her a lot more from the outside. And we talked about her being the driver of the story, like all the moral stakes are hers, not all of them, but simplifying things. I'm just saying all this to like kind of say that you can get real depth in these kinds of presentations, but ultimately, I mean, if you don't like them, you don't like them. I'm not going to convince you that you should like this more than you do. I'm just trying to explain like a way that I see it as having a depth that it's not a necessarily... There's a depth of character and depth of presentation that isn't necessarily a depth of subjectivity, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's not that I'm just trying to convince myself I should like it. I'm trying to figure out why I don't, you know?
Well, that's... Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's nothing wrong with it. And to hear you describe that this was an intentional choice, that it's obviously of merit to figure out what about this was good. And I'm like, well, I don't like it, so it don't make no sense, and it's good.
I really think, like, when we teach point of view, I read point of view, or you get a podcast talking about point of view. I'd say this all the time, but they simplify things so much that it really ruins it, because this is third person.
Yeah.
But a different third person story would be much more subjective. And we kind of assume, or the way we're taught is it needs to be subjective. Subjectivity is assumed as the baseline. It's either first person or third person. So in first person, you use I, and it's very subjective. It's the I person telling us all about them, and they see things through their eyes. In the third person, you change all the eyes to she or he, and it's the third person and how they feel and what they're experiencing, but it's also very subjective. We rarely talk in those things about stepping back. You'll get a nod to omniscient, but the omniscient's an old style that people don't use anymore. But it's not merely the omniscient, it's the objective, standing outside of somebody and looking at them. That's a third person. So I think it might be modern sensibilities in this case, although there's plenty of stuff written nowadays that doesn't have as much subjectivity as
right
as you would expect. there's nods to it. And I hear people talk about like, oh, this story has great characters. And you're like, why did you think that?
Why did you think that, you idiot? So, I guess you've hinted then at your takeaway.
Oh, please tell me, because I didn't know I had one.
I don't know. You seem to enjoy the fact that this was an intentional choice on his part. Like, there's something to be learned in just letting the story do the story.
Yeah, I guess that should be my takeaway, because that is what I reacted to, is
Right.
reading that little thing about, as Conrad characterized it, just the facts.
Yeah.
I've said a lot about that, so I guess I don't need
So
to.
you're good. The only thing I could think for mine was, I know we've talked about it here, and I feel like my phrasing of this is something that you said, but obviously not something you came up with. I don't know. But we've talked in the past about like how if you want to make a story continue to like unfold, like things have to get increasingly worse for a character, right?
It's one way to think of it. Yeah, it was George
Yeah.
Saunders. The book was he said escalate. You always escalate things.
Yeah. And I've talked about that in my own workshop a lot since then because I think it's easier to see like in TV, you know, where you're watching season six of a show and you're like, why the hell are we on season six? And it's like, well, because things have gotten worse, not better, right?
Yeah.
And you might be working toward the same goal and things might be shifting in the correct direction. But for the most part, stories like this are stories that continue because the character continues to make bad decisions. So I feel like sometimes I'll feel as if my own character is stuck, especially in a longer work. And it's because things have not gotten worse. We're still trying to solve that initial problem and we're going about it intelligently or pragmatically or whatever. And that doesn't make for exciting stories, you know, unless you're going to do something else as the writer. But especially knowing now that this is an intentional sort of pared down type of storytelling, the only way to give it movement is to sort of complicate things and then see how the character reacts to that, reacts to that, reacts to that. Or else this might be a story about honesty. She loses her necklace and she tells her friend and it's over. But the story is not that. The story is the cover up and the reason why she might feel compelled to cover up, knowing what we know about her up until this point, that she can't lose face in front of this woman. And so she's going to dedicate a decade to hard work to fix something, only to find out that she didn't need to do that in the first place. And that's a really good example of just making things worse for your character. I remember like talking about it that way too, with you or whatever, about how you as the writer have to make it more difficult too.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just that your character is on the page doing stupid things, making bad choices, like being themselves. You as the writer should also be introducing hurdles to that goal to make it all that more interesting. And it helps to do all of what we've talked about, which is like ratchet the stakes and how bad does this character want it? But I'm finding myself stuck at a point in a short story that I'm writing, and I thought of that recently. And now when I think about having to go back to it, it pains me to think about how I need to make it more difficult because
Yeah.
you think that you're on a certain trajectory to solve this problem and you've already gone so far down this hole and you haven't solved it yet. So why would I introduce more complexity? And it's like, well, because the story's not done and it's not moving. And I think this is a very clear example of it because at first we think that the problem is she wants to go to the ball or that, you know, she's excluded from society and then a solution presents itself. She's invited, but then she doesn't want to go because she doesn't have enough money. And then the solution is that she has to ask for it and then her husband gives it to her and then she needs to top it off. So she needs to really humble herself and ask her friend a favor and she gives it to her, but then she loses it and the stakes are higher than they ever have been. And what does she do now? She makes it worse again. There's another hurdle. Yeah. So this felt like a very clear escalation that way.
So that final twist at the end.
Yeah. And I didn't know that that twist was coming, but I knew that something was,
Yes.
I knew based on how much they were going to have to work to pay this off that she was making a bad choice. Cause I was thinking to myself, would I do that? No, I'm not going to take out loans and work hard for that long to pay off a friend for a piece of jewelry. I'm going to flee the country before I do that.
I mean, you could get rid of that whole last section where it turns out to be fake, and it would still have a lot of the same
Yes.
feelings to it. Because they, for one night, what they had to do, like, even if it turned out to be a real necklace and they spent all that time, what would she have said at the end? It's like, well, thanks for paying it back. Like, you ruined yourself for me.
Or she would have been like, oh, I forgot all about this.
It didn't even have to twist, is what I'm saying. It's like, it could
Yeah.
just be like, okay, that happened. You paid it off. You
Yeah, she
ruined
just kind of
yourself
walks
for it.
away empty either way. Yeah, like to not get the satisfaction or the payoff of gratefulness even.
But
Oh, thank you so much.
the twist undermines everything. It's like you did it for
Yeah.
nothing.
Yes.
You still did all that stuff. You still went through that. You still lived that life. But the twist is you didn't need to.
LOL.
Yeah, that's why that's an escalation, because it the important thing about the escalation is it doesn't erase everything that happened before. It like builds on it. It takes everything that happens before and twists it and reconstructs it.
Yeah. And now she has a different interpretation of what all of that work meant.
Yeah. It's like everything along the way, this is, just read the book. Saunders' book is very good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But everything along the way is an escalation. You start with small escalations and you build up to bigger and bigger, bigger ones. Even like the introduction of the kind of person she is, it's an escalation to invite her to this ball.
Yes.
It's an escalation that she doesn't have the necklace and she needs to go borrow one, right? All those points along the way are escalations on the situation. Losing it is an escalation.
Massive.
Yeah. But it's all working within that same, like if you think of a story with a theme, it's all working within a theme. This is the story. So these are the moments that escalate that particular thing that makes it a cohesive story. It's not like you're like, all of a sudden her sister dies and they have to deal with that. It's like, it's always the same thing.
Yeah. It's all in keeping with the ultimate goal.
Yeah. Or you can think of it both ways. Either the ultimate goal at the end, like what you're going towards, or I want to say entelechial because it's the Aristotelian term. But what is kind of like established, the seed out of which everything grows at the beginning?
Yes.
Whatever is there in the beginning.
Yeah. So it's accurate to say like escalations on a theme.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.